Okay, we're beginning here with the Mishnah on Samach Gimel Amud Aleph. The Mishnah begins, Amoredet al Baala, a woman who rebels against her husband. The first question of the Gemara will be, what does it mean, Moredet? What exactly is she refusing to do that classifies her as being Moredet? Then, Pochatim la Miktubata. Then we start to reduce as a penalty or as a fine, we reduce the value of her Ktubah, Shiva Dinarim B'Shabbat, 7 dinar, each week. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Shiva Tarpi Ikin. The Gemara will discuss that in tomorrow's daf, but that's half a dinar, or he says the amount is half as much as the Tanakama. Ad Matai Hu Pochet. How far can he go? Meaning that how much money can he reduce from the Ktubah? Ad Kenege Ktubata. Until he's wiped out the entirety of her Ktubah. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Lolom Hu Pochet. Beolech. You can continue to find the woman even beyond the value of her Ktubah. Achim Tipola Yerushami Makom Acher, to the point where if there's some Yerusha that comes to her from another place that wasn't there at the time, Kovaimenu, then it'll be an outstanding debt that she owes him once he reaches the full value of her Ktubah. Goes beyond that, then he's able to garner those items because she becomes indebted to him, and therefore he has a lien on anything or any assets that she will get in the future. V'chein amored al ishto. And similarly, a man who rebels against his wife, Mosifim al Ktubata. Do the opposite. You add on or you increase the value of the Ktubah, Shlosha Dinarim B'Shabbat, 3 dinar per week. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, and again here Rabbi Yehuda disagrees and says it's Shlosha Tar Paikin, which is half a dinar, half the amount of the Tanakama. Now as far as the 7 and 3 are concerned, our Gemara is going to say or seems to indicate that it's connected to the days of the week. Each day of the week that she is rebelling, then there's a deduction of a dinar. And so therefore over a week there's 7 dinarim. With regards to the man, it's half as much. Should have been 3.5 instead of 3. And the Gemara discussed why that's not the case. The reason to differentiate between the man and the woman is because the woman's refusal, as the Gemara will say, is much more impactful and deleterious towards the relationship and for the man. It's much more difficult for him to live with than the man's rebelling or the man's refusal to do certain things. And therefore, there's a differentiation between the 7 and the 3. Tosafot over here quotes from the Yerushalmi that the reason for the 7 and the 3 has to do with the obligations of the woman and the man. The woman, as the Mishnah previously indicated, has melachot, certain things that she has to do for her husband. Enumerated in that Mishnah were 7 items. So, connected those 7 items, the penalty is 7 dinarim per week. On the other hand, the husband has obligations, mina Torah, towards the wife, which is Shirak Suta Ve'onata. So those are 3 obligations towards his wife, and therefore his penalty each week is 3 dinarim. So that's the way the Yerushalmi explains it. It's clear that the Bavli, our Gemara here, does not accept that, it does not bring that as the reason. Nevertheless, many of the Rishonim, like the Bavli at Tosafot over here, point out that is the reason for the 7 and the 3. In addition, some of the Rishonim point out to the fact that the Yerushalmi qualifies that and says that it's only according to one of the opinions that we're going to see coming up in the Gemara that Moredet is a woman who refuses to do the melachot that she's obligated in the previous Mishnayot that we saw for her husband. So that reason then, according to the Shalmi, would make sense about the 7 dinarim. Whereas according to those that believe that there's another reason or she's rebelling for other reasons, then that can't be the reason. And therefore the Bavli's reason will become important for those alternate opinions. But there are those that say that even according to other opinions, this still might be the penalty for refusal to do what you're supposed to do. Tosafot back on Samach Vet Amud Bet actually makes a calculation that shows that this number that the Mishnah is giving is actually the value of the Tashmish, and that's why there's 3 dinarim over here. And that is because an individual says that he's not going to be mazin et ishto, but rather do it through a third party. He has to give that third party 2 kabin per week in order to provide mizonot for his wife, and he still has to have Tashmish with her. On the other hand, like our Mishnah says, if he desists or refuses to have Tashmish amita with her, has to pay an extra 3 dinarim per week in order to make up for the fact that he's not providing her with tashmish. As the Bavli Tosafot point out, that in a situation where Dalet Zayin, 4 sa'ah, are bought with a selah, and 3 dinarim means 3/4 of a selah, that means that each dinar buys you a sa'ah worth of food, and therefore if you take 3 dinarim, you would actually get 3 sa'ah. 3 sa'ah is equal to 18 kavin. And therefore now you have a relationship between a person who provides mizonot for his wife but does give her tashmish. He has to give her 2 kavin. Whereas if an individual refuses to give tashmish, he has to give her 18 kavin. And there is a difference between a ratio of 9 to 1. And that's what the Gemara said on yesterday's daf. Rotzei isha bekav v'tiflut. A woman would rather 1 kav and have her husband present and have her husband to accompany her, may asara kabim uprishut, rather than 10 kav and separation. So the additional 9 kav are the value of the tashmish, or relationship of 9 to 1. And therefore the 3 dinar accord with what we said in the Gemara yesterday with regards to what a woman prefer, having her husband present, than more money. That ratio of 9 to 1 is the relationship between having the husband and having tashmish for the value we would consider to be equal. And therefore the penalty here is 3 dinar per week for the withholding of the tashmish. So that's the first thing in the Mishnah, the difference between the 7 and the 3. The next thing to discuss in the Mishnah is how much of her ketubah can be penalized. There's a machloket here between Rabbi Yossi and the Tana Kama. Rabbi Yossi says you can go beyond the ketubah, even into Yerusha, even to her future assets, or assets that she will inherit. According to Rabbi Yossi, it includes everything in the ketubah. Kor ketubah, tosefta ketubah, the nidunya, the dowry that's placed in the ketubah, the nixtei tzona barzel, nixtei malog, and any other items that she's yoreshet. Those are all included in Rabbi Yossi's right that he grants to the husband to penalize the wife for being a moredet. The question is the Tana Kama's opinion, who says ad keneged tubata. The simple reading of it is keneged tubata means the kor ketubah, or maybe the kor ketubah tosefet. Whereas we're seeing the Rishonim, the Rine over here quotes from Rambam that the ketubah here includes everything in the ketubah except for the nixtei malog. He says the nixtei malog are not included in this penalty, and that's not part of the ketubah. And therefore, Rabbi Yossi argues on the Tana Kama in 2 areas. He allows, number 1, nixtei malog to be penalized. In addition to that, he allows you to create a future obligation so that any Yerusha that comes during the future would also be subject to this penalty. On the other hand, he quotes from the Ramban, and this is the shita that he favors, is that the ketubah here includes everything, including the nixtei malog. Ketubah is all-inclusive. The only thing it excludes is future Yerusha or a future obligation. In that sense, that means that if while she is rebelling, she gets a Yerusha, even according to the Tana Kama, that's subject to the penalties. Because the only thing he argues on with Rabbi Yossi or with regards to Rabbi Yossi is future Yerusha. But anything that is in her hands now or assets that are with her now, those can be garnished, penalized for her rebellion. The Rashba takes it one step further and says that the Mishnah cites over here, ad keneged tubata. Ad keneged tubata means until. That's the final stage. That means that you can garnish from all assets that she has prior to penalizing her ketubah. Any asset she has is subject to this penalty. And then once you run through all of those assets, then you begin to diminish the ketubah until the point that you go through everything, including her nixtei malog. Now, what's interesting, as the Ran points out, is that the penalty is a fixed amount. It's 7 dinarim. That is the value that we're going to reduce from these items. And as he points out, that the value of, for instance, with assets which were granted to her, gifted to her, to the exclusion of her husband's ownership, there she has full principal and leasehold ownership in them, are different than the value of the nixtei malog. Because 7 dinar from those items are items that where she has full control over them and they're under her total ownership. Whereas by nixtei malog, the payroll belongs to the husband and only the principal belongs to her. And therefore there is a difference in the underlying value of these items because of the control that she has. Nevertheless, the penalty is a fixed penalty, and the Ran points out that you'll still deduct 7 dinarim of value from that at the same rate that you would deduct from the nixtei malog, 7 dinarim. And obviously the Ran is assuming that land has a static value, and therefore 7 dinarim in each one of these will give you the same amount of land, even though the rights to the land are different in each of these cases. Obviously, if you value the land based on the ownership rights, then 7 dinarim of nixtei malog will be different than 7 dinarim of full and clear ownership, and therefore it would be adjusted by that mechanism, because the value would reflect the ownership rights. But the Ran assumes all land has the same value, irrespective of the ownership rights. And therefore, the reduction of 7 dinarim is of a different value because of those controlling rights. Nevertheless, the Chachamim were lo plug b'divrem. They didn't make a distinction between how much you take from each one of these assets. So now the Gemara continues and says, Miuredet mimai. What exactly is she rebelling against? What exactly is she refusing to do? She refuses to engage in marital relations with her husband. And that is her rebellion. Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina omar, imalacha. She refuses to do work. Now, Bali et Tosafot over here, in their first explanation, claim that this machloket is related to a machloket that we saw just earlier. And that is, who has controlling rights when it comes to the quid pro quo that the woman's maaseh yadayim entitle her to mizonot, entitle her to that her husband gives her. If you say that the woman is the controlling party here, then she can say, I don't want to work and I won't take mizonot. Then if you think the husband is the controlling party here, then the husband can say, I'm not going to feed you, keep your maaseh yadayim. But in that instance, the woman doesn't have a right to refuse to work. So let the Baal Yisrael point out that his Rav Huna is consistent in his opinion. Rav Huna back there said that the woman is the controlling party. And since she's the controlling party, if she refuses to do malacha, it's not a big deal. Because she can just refuse to do malacha, and the husband will say, okay, then you don't get mizonot. And that's the right of the woman to do such, and she wouldn't be considered a moredet. That's why Rav Huna says over here, the moredet, the rebellious nature of the woman, is in the fact that she doesn't engage in marital relations. Because malacha is something that she can opt out of, because she's the controlling party. On the other hand, Tosafot claims that Rav Yossi and Rabbi Chanina believes that the controlling party is the husband. Therefore, the wife's refusal to do malacha is an abrogation of the husband's rights because he is the one who controls, and if he's giving her mizonot, she needs to do the malacha. And the fact that she doesn't do the malacha is a rebellion or a abrogation of the husband's rights, and that's why we're going to compel her to do the right thing and to do the malacha that she's supposed to do in this instance. So the Baal Tosafot claimed that that is the background to the machloket here, is knowing who's the controlling party, and based on that, determines what you think is the problem over here. Problem over here will be determined as to whether you think the woman can opt out of doing malacha, or it's the husband that can opt out of giving mizonot. And those two opinions then have influence on whether you think it's tashmisha mitah or melacha. Underlying the Baal Tosafot's position, which they substantiate over here, is that when the woman says she doesn't want mizonot, she then is entitled not to do any of the melachot that are found in that previous mishnah. The seven melachot that we mentioned before, all of those are traded off against the mizonot. And therefore the Baal Tosafot say that the amount of production that the woman has to do for a maaseh yadayim of chamesh slayim be-Yehuda, eser slayim be-Galil, that production rate is reduced by the other melachot that she does. So for instance, if she bakes, if she cooks, she does other work in the house, those values will then be deducted from the tzemer that she has to do, because the entire package is what is quid pro quo for the mizonot. The Ran disagrees with the Baal Tosafot and says that the quid pro quo here is only between mizonot and the tzemer and the wool that she has to produce. That's the only quid pro quo. The other six melachot that she has to do are independent of mizonot. And whether she takes mizonot or doesn't take mizonot, she's obligated to give those six melachot. And therefore, according to the Ran, as the Baal Tosafot themselves point out, if you think that, then you can't say the machloket here between Rav Huna and Rav Yossi and Rabbi Chanina relates to that previous machloket. Because even according to Rav Huna, in this view of the Ran, if the woman refuses to do malacha, she's in violation of the husband's rights, because he has rights to those six other melachot that she can't refuse to do, even if you believe she's able to trade off her maaseh yadayim for mizonot and say, I won't take mizonot and I'll take my maaseh yadayim. Tosafot dismisses the possibility that the melachot that we're speaking about here are the shalosh melachot that a woman must do for her husband because they are derech chiba, and that is mezigat kos, hatzat amita, v'chitzat panav yadav regalav. And he says that those are not the melachot that are being spoken about here, because there's no obligation on the woman to do those items, and Beit Din cannot compel her to do it. Tosafot says that those are activities of intimacy that engenders love and affection between the couple, and therefore we would advise the woman to do it, but it's not a right of the husband that he can demand, and therefore that cannot be the melachot that we're speaking about here. And therefore the Rishonim have different views as to what Rav Huna thinks. According to the Baal Tosafot, Rav Huna thinks that melacha is not an issue at all with regards to her abstaining from doing malacha. According to the Ravid on the opposite side of the spectrum, and according to the Ran, even Rav Huna agrees by the other six malachot, besides the making, producing of tzemer, that is considered to be moredet, and they only argue about the malacha of tzemer as to whether she can abstain from doing that. It's her right or it's his right, as we noted before. Most of the Rishonim, like the Ramban and others, favor the view of the Baal Tosafot, that you cannot compel the woman to do these melachot, that she's not considered to be a moredet by abstaining or desisting from doing all these melachot for her husband. But then all the Rishonim have to deal with the fact that then the household is missing these items that the woman was supposed to do. And how does the whole household make up for it? So the Rambam takes a very strong position, which is that you can use any means to compel her, to force her to do those items. The Rimi Gash suggests that you do it through nidui, And the Ramban says that you do it whatever other methodologies that we have or pressures that we can bring to bear on her, even though her desisting from Malacha is not considered to be an abrogation of the husband's rights. And the Ra'a continues to explain that if this woman refuses to do the Malacha, she can hire a Shifcha to replace this woman and to make up for the work that she's not doing, and that will be deducted from her ketubah as well. Others say that that is what the deduction from the ketubah is for, is to pay for a Shifcha to make up for the work that she's not doing that she was supposed to contribute to the family. So, according to the majority of Rishonim, Rav Huna does not believe that her desisting from Malacha is considered to be Moredet, although Beit Din does compel the woman to engage in those activities because they're basic activities of the house that are necessary, and she will be penalized if she doesn't do it. The Baal Yad Tosafot therefore ask about Moredet, why are we bothering to penalize her or fine her in order for her to do the work? Why don't we just compel her or force her to do the work, like some of these other Rishonim are suggesting? And Tosafot comes to the conclusion that we wouldn't do that because the husband is going to say, Ein Adam Dar Im Nachash Bikfifa. That's a common expression, which is that a person doesn't want to live together with a snake inside of a basket. Snake is a dangerous animal, can bite at any time, can cause you problems. A person doesn't live with someone who has animosity towards them or is being compelled to do this against their will. And therefore the husband says, if you're going to force her to do it, that's not going to result in a good marital situation. And therefore, either she's compelled by the fine to come to a better conclusion, or he can demand that she gets divorced without receiving her ketubah because of the fact that compelling her or forcing her is not going to make it a good situation. So the Gemara challenges the position of Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Chanina from our Mishnah that says, Nan, Cheno Moreid Al Ishto, a husband who rebels against his wife is a recalcitrant husband. Bishlam Alaman Demar Mitbal Tashmish, according to Rav Huna, who says that the woman's desisting from doing what she's obligated to do is marital relations, then that same issue can be an obligation of the husband towards the wife, because he is obligated to provide her onata. Therefore, you're going to have mirida, both from the side of the woman and the side of the man. So, lechayet, that's okay, that can be explained. According to Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanino, who says that her mirida, her rebelliousness, or desisting from work, is melacha, mi mishubada. Since when is the husband obligated to provide the woman with work or malacha that he would consider a moreid if he doesn't work? Where it says, in, bomer, enizan, veni mifarnes. He says to the woman, I'm not going to supply you with mizonot, and I'm not going to sustain you or support you. So Gemara says about that, v'amarav, homer, enizan, veni mifarnes. A husband who makes that type of declaration, yotzi v'tein ketubah. He has to divorce her immediately and give a ketubah. And our Mishnah says that you go through this period of time with the penalties. And so that's a much slower process. Whereas Rav is saying that you immediately have to have a divorce. So how can you reconcile those two things? Mar says, V'lav l'meluchei bei boi. The girsa that we have is the girsa of Rashi, which is that don't we have to check with the man anyway? Meaning that we have to give him a chance to do tshuva. We have to give him a chance to change his mind. That's Ein Ochanami according to Rav. The divorce needs to take place immediately, or the ketubah must be given immediately. But immediately doesn't really mean immediately. It means after we've gone through this process of Beit Din that tries to encourage him to do the right thing. If we can't compel him or encourage him to do the right thing by penalizing him through the ketubah, then we say he has to get divorced. So that's the way Rashi explains it. Many of the Rishonim reject that view of Rashi, since the Gemara never gives any span of time over which this takes place, and neither did Rav. So how do you reconcile that? So they change the girsa to say, V'lav limnuchei ba boy. Don't we have to check with the woman? The woman gets to make a decision here. She can go for the immediate solution, which is what Rav is suggesting. She has a right to demand a divorce and her ketubah immediately. Or Beit Din can offer the opportunity to say, let us see if we can convince your husband to do the right thing. And she has a right to say, let's give it some time. And when giving it time, the husband will be penalized week by week if he doesn't alter his way. So there is a situation in which the husband will penalize for not providing for his wife. And even though the obligation of the wife, according to Rav Huna in Malacha, is not sufficient grounds to consider to be a moredet, the lack of Malacha by the husband is considered to be a moreid because of the difference in their position, meaning that the husband can replace the woman's refusal to work or her absence in certain Malachot of the house by hiring someone or bringing someone in. A woman, especially in their time, didn't have the means by which to support herself. Therefore, the husband's refusal to work is a serious violation of the woman's rights. And that's why over here, Rav says that she's entitled to make a decision to immediately to get divorced and receive her ketubah, rather than have to wait while her husband is being penalized, because in the meantime, she's going to starve, and she's going to have no means of support. And for that reason, she can decide to terminate the relationship immediately, or go the slower route, but that depends on her, but not, and given, it will give him time to relent on his mistaken position that he is taking. That's the way the Ramban explains the difference. Why, according to Rav Huna, we differentiate between the woman's refusal to do melacha and the husband's refusal to do melacha. And Tosva makes the same comment here, that why don't we just force him to support her rather than divorce her? And he says the same answer that he gave before, Ein Adam Dar Im Nachash B'Kfifa, that the woman's not going to want a situation in which they're forcing or compelling the husband to support her, because that's not going to lead to a good relationship, and she'd rather just get out of the relationship and get paid out her ketubah. Therefore, we don't force him to provide the parnasa. Rather, we give her the option to force him to give a get, or at her discretion, to give him time and penalize him through the ketubah by adding money to the ketubah to see if he changes his mind. Now, exactly what the issue is a machloket. Rashi says, "Eni zan v'eni mefarnes, dehainu tachat melacha." The case here is a case where she provided ma'aseh yadayim to the husband, and now he's refusing quid pro quo to return or supply her with mizonot, and therefore he is in default or negligent in providing her with mizonot, which she is entitled to because she gave him her ma'aseh yadayim. That's how Rashi explains "Eni zan v'eni mefarnes." Whereas the Bele Atosavot here bring from the Rabbeinu Eliyahu that there's a more generic or general requirement on the husband to work in order to provide for his family. He needs to provide parnosa and mizonot for his family, and he may not desist or opt out of working in order to provide for his family. So it's a more generic requirement. The Rabbeinu Eliyahu goes as far as to say that that requirement is not simply that he goes to work and he provides, but that he is actually personally liable for that. And that means that he has to do whatever means are possible to provide for his family. That's what Rabbeinu Eliyahu says over here. Mikan mochiach Rabbeinu Eliyahu shechayav adam laskir atzmo lelamei tinokot ulasot melacha acheret kedei lazon et ishto. Person has an obligation to hire himself out in order to provide for his wife, because the obligation is a personal liability. It's not just on his assets. The demand for him to work is a personal obligation, according to the Rabbeinu Eliyahu. And he bases it on our Gemara here, that if he says, and he's unveinu mefarnes, that he is compelled then to deal with the situation, either to get divorced or to take care of the situation. And we can compel him to do that, or there's a demand on him to take care of this situation. One of the proofs of the Rabbeinu Eliyahu is that it says in the Ketubah, Ana falach ve'afarnes, I will work and provide for you. So that's an obligation to provide for his wife. The Rabbeinu Tam says that that may not be the case, either because you can explain the Gemara here like Rashi, or the Rabbeinu Tam rejects that proof from the Ketubah, because he says the flach hainu avodat karka perush acharosh ve'anachesh ve'ador et asadeh, I'll do all the work on the field, v'avim izonot debayit, and I will bring food home. But to rent himself out, to hire himself out, that he's not obligated to do. That obligation might simply to be that I have to work the field, I have to be productive and produce from the field. But that may not be a personal obligation whereby he has to hire himself out if he can't work in the field, if he can't bring mizonot back for his family from farming. And every year you have a machloket between the Rabbeinu Eliyahu and the Rabbeinu Tam as to whether there's such a personal obligation on the individual to provide parnassah to the point where he would have to hire himself out. And this goes to a broader question about loan obligations, which we discussed in the Tosfot at the beginning of the Perek, whether a person has personal liability for a loan, or he simply has an obligation that devolves upon his assets to repay the loan. And even if you want to say that by a loan, there is no personal liability, and the individual doesn't have to hire themselves out, the Chazon Ish says that maybe here by mizonot it would be different because of the nature of the obligation. The nature of the obligation is together with sheirach, suta, ve'onata. And just like onata is something that is an obligation on the individual himself, and he can't discharge it through a third party, so too, mizonot may not just be a simple obligation or chov, liability for the husband, but might be a personal obligation like onata, and therefore he would have the obligation to hire himself out, and would have the obligation to do whatever it took in order to provide that which he's obligated to provide his wife. So Meitavei, now we have a braita, Tosefta, that's going to be brought on the second half of today's daf. It says, Achat li arusa, unisua, vafilu nida, vafilu chola, vafilu shomeret yabam. All of these individuals are subject to this penalty, if they are moredet, if they are individuals who do not abide by the obligations that they have to the marriage. Now, there are a number of problems here. One of them is arusa, because arusa has no obligation towards the husband, not in tashmish, and not in melacha. And shomeret yabam also does not necessarily have obligation. She can say she doesn't want to perform yibum, even though it's not in her choice. Beit Din will try to protect her if she really doesn't want to be together with this yabam. So why can't she refuse in these instances to get married? So what you have to say in both of these instances is that the arusa is a case where she's refusing to get married. She's acquiesced, she's become engaged halachically to this individual. The year time has elapsed, and now she's refusing to get married or consummate the nisuin. And so she's a problem here because she's holding out on this husband, even though she says she wants to get married. So that could be one way that the arusa is problematic. Or another way the Ritva suggests is that a possibility that after the 12 months elapse, she does become obligated in the melachot towards her husband to provide to her husband, and therefore her desisting from them is considered to be recalcitrance, and therefore she would be subject to these penalties. And the same with the yabam. The shomeret yabam is under the same rubric as the arusa, which is either she's refusing to consummate the yibum, or the time period that she was given to get ready for the yibum has elapsed now, and then maybe according to the Ritva, she's chayevet in the melachot, and she's refusing to do them. Now, the problem that the Gemara is going to raise here is with regards to nida, which is bishlam alamad amar melacha shapir. According to one who says that melacha is considered to be the rebelliousness of the woman, that works out well. Alamad amar mitashmish, one who says that she's abstaining from marital relations, nida batashmishi, why would a nida be considered to be a rebellious woman if she's not engaging in marital relations? She's not allowed to engage in marital relations, so why is she considered to be problematic? Samar lecha will answer, there's a big difference between someone who has a bird in hand and someone who does not. I'm going to defer explaining this. It's going to come up on the second half of the day's daf, and we'll explain it there. As you can see, this part of the Gemara is in parentheses, and that's because Rashi took it out of the Girsa, because there are a number of reasons not to believe that it belongs here. One of which is that the Gemara is going to ask it on the second half of the daf as if it never took place before and they didn't give that answer already. So the fact that it speaks about it on the second half of the daf implies that it wasn't spoken about yet. The other reason is that the problem here is problem for the one who says melacha just as much as it is for Rav Huna who says tashmish. Yeah, nida is a problem of tashmish, but melacha also has a problem because the Braita says afilu nida. Afilu nida means it sounds like nida has something different about her that wouldn't be so clear as to why, wouldn't make it as obvious that she is considered to be rebellious. Now, if you say it's about tashmish, that makes sense. But if you say it's about melacha, then how can you explain this braita as saying alfilu nida? Because why is the nida any different than a woman who's teorah that is doing melacha for her husband? She has to do those melachot anyway, no matter when it is. And therefore, afilu nida doesn't make a lot of sense. And that's why, according to most Rishonim, does not belong in the Girsa over here. Tosfot does answer that question on the second Amud when the Gemara asks this question again. And there he says that a nida has a din of a chola. It's considered to be partially sick. And therefore, a chola, as we're seeing in a second in the Gemara, is exempt from doing these melachot. And that exemption maybe should have applied by nida. And then we say, no, afilu nida. She's not considered to be so sick that she doesn't have to do the melachot, even though she is partially sick or partially ill because of the difficulties of her menstruation. Or does what suggests that maybe that's even though she's a nida and she's unable to do the melachot that are considered to be intimate melachot because those are derechiba, which are restricted during the time that she is in nida. So therefore, you would have thought maybe her rebelliousness not to do the melachot during that period of time is not considered to be rebelliousness. Nevertheless, there's no connection or correlation between those melachot of chiba, which she can't do during her time of nida, and the other melachot, which she is obligated to do during her time of nida. But that would explain why it's afilu nida, even though she's exempt from those other melachot, it doesn't make her exempt or not considered rebellious if she does not do the main seven melachot that she's obligated towards her husband. And here is the nature of the question, which goes in the opposite direction, which is bishma lamanda mart mitashmish, where the one says tashmish, anu duktani chola. That's why someone who's sick is mentioned over here. Lamanda marmi melacha, the one who says malacha, chola bat malachahi, since when can you compel a woman to do malacha when she's a chola? Now, when she's a chola, she doesn't want to do malacha or she can't do malacha. She also doesn't want to engage in tashmish. But the reason she doesn't want to engage in tashmish is because she has no desire for it or she's not interested in it. But that doesn't mean that she can't engage in Tashmish. And therefore, over here, when you say afilu chola, means that even a chola is considered rebellious if she refuses or abstains from engaging in marital relations. That's understandable. But if you say malacha is the problem, a chola can't do malacha. How can you compel her to do malacha if she's incapable or does not have the strength to do malacha? Ella, the conclusion of the Gemara is, mi tashmish, kuli amalo plige, dehiavi moredet. When it comes to tashmish and mita, everybody agrees if she abstains from that, if she's recalcitrant with regards to that, she is considered to be a rebellious woman and should be penalized like the Mishnah says. Ki plige, the machlog between Rav Huna and Rav Yossi and Rabbi Chanina is mi malacha, with regards to malacha. Is malacha subject to the same sanctions of the woman if she refuses to do malacha? Mar savar malacha lo avi moredet. Rav Huna says that from malacha she's not considered to be a moredet. Now, according to the Balei HaTosafot, that means that even if she doesn't do any of the seven malachot that are demanded of her, she's not considered to be a moredet. According to the Ran, only if she doesn't produce tzemer is she not considered to be a moredet. But the other six malachot, he would agree, Rav Huna, that she is classified as a moredet. Umar 7, Rav Yosef Rechanina believes, mi malacha, nami avi moredet. Even from malacha, according to the Balei HaTosafot, all seven malachot are considered to be moredet. And according to the Ran, that he's different from Rav Huna only with regards to the production of tzemer, where he says that is also considered to be a moredet. Now the Gemara says, gufa, a moredet al ba'ala. This is the braita we just brought, the tosefta that we just brought before to ask this question for. It says in that tosefta that a woman who is moredet ba'a, pochotim la miktubata shiva darim b'shabat, yodomer shiva tarpi ki ikim. That's the quote from the Mishnah, as well as the quote from the tosefta, that there's a penalty on her ketubah to deduct every weekly 70 dinarim. Yehuda says half that amount, shiva tarapa ikim. Each one of those is a half dinar, so seven of them is 3.5 dinar. And now we have the alternative view, which is Rabbi Tenu Chazru v'nimnu. Rabbi Tenu got together, and they decided that this is the way to deal with this problem. One who is a moredet, shu machrizina le arba shabbatot zu acharzu, that you're going to announce 4 weeks in a row about this woman's refusal to do what she is obligated to do. V'sholchim la beit din, and the beit din sends to her information indicating to her that she stands in her refusal and does not relent on her position. Havayodat shafilu ktubatech me'amaneh, even if your ktubah is worth 100 maneh, which is 10,000 dinar, a massive ktubah, hifsad, you're going to lose out on that ktubah. And now the bright the tosefta continues, which we just quoted before. Achat li arusa unisua, vafilu nida, vafilu chola, vafilu shomeret yavam. All these individuals are considered to be moredet, but the way that we deal with it is not by deducting from the ktubah on a weekly basis, but rather having 4 weeks of pressure placed upon her. If she continues to refuse, she loses out on her ktubah, and the husband can divorce her without having to pay her ktubah. Achat li arusa, it doesn't matter if she's an arusa, nisua, vafilu nida, vafilu chola, vafilu shomeret yavam. So this is that same question that we had before. That's part of why some of the Rishonim don't think it should be in the Girsa. In all likelihood, the question here should have preceded this Gufa in the Mishnah, because it's a question on the Braita itself that we brought before, as well as on this Tosefta that we're bringing here, which is, what does Afilu Nida mean if you believe the problem is Tashmish Hamita? So Gemara says, since when does she engage in marital relations? Can't compare someone who has a loaf in hand to someone who doesn't have a loaf in hand. Meaning, this is employed by fasting, by Yom HaKippurim, for the individual who goes to take the Seir Mishtaleach out, that all the huts along the way he had food to eat in case he needed to break his fast, which he was entitled to do. But in the end, he never did break his fast. The knowledge that he could break his fast and that there was food available to him is enough to power him on and to allow him to continue fasting. That is the psychology many times of a fast. When you finish a fast day and you can continue fasting onward because you know that at any moment or whenever you decide you can eat, whenever you continue fasting, even though during the fast day itself you were aching and having a hard time, that's because during that period of time you couldn't eat. The possibility or the ability to eat at any moment gives the person strength to continue on. And so too over here. If the individual knows that after his wife is a nidah, she will become Torah and return to him and provide marital relations, then he feels comfortable even though now she's separated from him. On the other hand, if she is refusing to have tashmish with him, then the nidah never ends. And therefore he is, during the time period of the nidah, he's going to feel angst because he knows that even after she becomes Torah from Anida, she's not going to return to him, and therefore it's Ein Papas Salo. He doesn't have a loaf of bread in his basket. He doesn't have the food that's ready for him to assuage his hunger pangs, or over here to assuage his desire to be together with his wife. Now the Ran brings from the Yerushalmi over here that the refusal of the woman to engage in relations has to have started before she became a Nida. If it started before she became a Nida and then she happens to become a Nida, then during the period of time that she is a Nida, we continue to penalize her because of this concept of Papas Salo. But if she only initiated her rebellion while she is a Nida, the Yerushalmi says that that's not considered to be a rebellion and that we don't penalize her during that period of time. And the Ran speculates that's maybe because she's just toying with him a little bit. She knows she can't be with him anyway, and therefore she's playing around with him a little bit. We wouldn't encourage that. We wouldn't suggest that. But because of that, we don't necessarily consider it to be a rebellion if she starts the refusal while she's in Yidah, when she can't anyway be together with her husband. Now, as far as the Rabbeinu over here, the Gemara says, Amar Rami Bar Chama, Ein Machrizin Aleha LeBavatei Knesiyot UBavatei Midrashot. You only make these announcements in the shuls and in the Bate Midrash. Amar Rava, Rava says, Deikanami. You can be mitayek that at the lashon of the Braita. Yitani arba shabbatot zo achar zo. Because it says four shabbatot, one after the other. The Ran points out that it's zo achar zo is the key element over here, which is that if you had to make the announcements every day of the week, which is actually the Rambam Paskins, and the Rambam Shita is very difficult because it doesn't seem to coalesce with what the Gemara is saying over here. Nevertheless, most of the other Rishonim believe that it means every Shabbat you make the announcement. Because if you thought, the Ran says, that it meant every week, in 4 weeks in a row, you would know that. Every week, the next week comes after the week that's before it. So Zo Achar Zo, 1 week after the next, that's obvious, because you have to announce every day of the week. Then the next week, you have to announce every day, so it's going to be 1 week after the other. Zo Achar Zo is relevant when you're talking about a single day of the week. When you're talking about Shabbat, and it could be that Shabbat could be this Shabbat, then skip two, and then go another Shabbat. But when you say Zo Achar Zo, that means that they have to be one after the other. They have to be Ritzufim. They have to be sequential Shabbatot in order for you to be considered to be the announcements that we require. And so that Zo Achar Zo modifies Shabbatot, and it's only necessary if it's 1 day a week. Now, Rashi and the Bali Tosafot point out over here that it's on Shabbat itself because it's a day when people desist from work, a day that they're not engaged in business activities. They're not in the shuk. They're found in the Batei Knesiot to Batei Midrashot. The fact that Rami Bar Chama says they announce in the Batei Knesiot to Batei Midrashot is because that's a day when people are found there. That makes it the most public type of announcement. It gives it the most publicity that you would want. And therefore, the necessity to have it in the Batei Knesiot, Batei Midrashot is synonymous but the idea that the announcement happens on Shabbat. Now, according to those who believe that Shabbat would be every day of the week, then what would be the point of making those announcements in the shul and the Beit Midrash? That wouldn't get you the maximum exposure. The maximum exposure would do it in the shuk, or to do it in places where most of the people were gathered. And therefore, the two come together. The Shabbat and the Batei Knesiot, the Batei Midrashot, get you the maximum exposure because they are synonymous with each other. People are found in the Batei Midrash and Batei Knesiot on Shabbat. It's clear here that the point is that they're going to create a shaming mechanism for encouraging the woman to do the right thing. They're going to make these public announcements. And Amar Rami Bar Chama, Pamayim Shosholchim Lami Beitin. Beitin sends to her twice. Achat Kolam Achazah, Achat Achar Achazah. Once before they begin the sequence of announcements, once after they finish the sequence of announcements. So they tell her, we're going to do this in public. If you do not change your mind, you're going to be embarrassed in public. And then they go ahead and do it. And after they do that, they come back to her and say, have you changed your mind? That's the way that most read it. The right bit actually reads it that Achat Kol Machazah, Achat Achar Achazah is after each announcement, each one of the four Shabbatot. They tell her beforehand they're going to do it, and they inquire of her afterwards whether she's changed her mind. Now the Ran questions over here, what happens during those 4 weeks? According to the way that the Breita, the Tosefta lays it out, is that there's 4 weeks of announcements. After that, she loses her ketubah entirely. It's a one-shot deal. It's a waterfall event by which the end of 4 weeks, she loses her entire ketubah. What happens in the 4 weeks in the interim? Sounds like, for most of the Rishonim, that there is no deduction on her ketubah. She keeps her ketubah for those 4 weeks. So the Ran says, and this woman can play a game. She can wait till the end of the 4 weeks, and then at the last minute say, you know what, I relent. I'm going to go back to my husband. I'll do what I'm supposed to do. But then, she doesn't lose anything from her ketubah. Next time, 2 weeks later, she does the exact same thing. And then they have to restart the process, and she's not losing anything. So for that reason, some of the Rishonim believe that the penalties do apply for the 4 weeks, and each time she engages in this activity, she's going to get a reduction in her ketubah. If she continues or keeps it up for the entirety of the 4 weeks, she'll lose her entire ketubah in one shot, rather than in a slow pace of week by week. And that's the difference between the Rabbeinu Nimnu v'Gamru, their approach versus the approach of our Mishnah. Others say that according to Rabbeinu Nimnu v'Gamru, there is no deduction. And the way they prevent that problem is that the Ran says 4 weeks are a cumulative amount. Over her lifetime, she gets 4 weeks worth of announcements. If she uses up 2 weeks rebelling, then the next time she rebels, she only has 2 weeks left. And once they've accumulated the 4 weeks in altogether, then she loses her ketubah entirely. And that can be made up of one rebellion of 4 weeks, two rebellions of 2 weeks each, or four separate rebellions of 1 week each. As soon as she gets accumulated to 4 weeks, then she loses her ketubah. And that's how we prevent recurrence of these problems.
Darash Rav Nachman of Rav Chista, halacha k'rabotenu. He believes that the halacha is like Rabbeinu versus our Mishnah. I mean, the halacha is like the Tosefta, that we do this 4 week announcement, shaming, in order to get her to agree to relent on her position. If not, she loses her entire ketubah at the end of that period of time, as opposed to our Mishnah, which uses a more gradual penalty fine approach that takes down 7 dinarim per week until it eliminates her entire ketubah. Amar Rava, hi, Borcha. This statement, or this position, is that of a boor, of a Amaharet, someone who is uncouth, uneducated. I mean, it's not the right psak. Amar Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, my Borchute. Why is it problematic? What's so problematic about this psak? I'm the one who told him that that's the psak. And I said it over in the name of a great individual, Umanu. Who is that? Rabbi Yossi bar Rabbi Chanina. So his position, Rav Nachman bar Rav Chista's position, comes from me, first of all, and my position that I passed on to him came from a gavaraba of Rabbi Yossi bar Rabbi Chanina. So why are you dismissing it? Why are you discarding or demeaning his position? So the Gemara then says, "V'iu keman." Who does he hold like? Now, the way Rashi reads this thing is that Rova disagrees with Rav Nachman Rav Chista, who paskin like the Rabbeinu. Rova believes that the Lacha is like our Mishnah, and he thinks that someone who takes up the Tosefta in the face of a Mishnah is problematic, and that's why he was upset about that position being taken. And that's why he calls it a borcha. And the Gemara wants to know, but where's the support for Rava's position? Rava's a batra, but here Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak and Rav Nachman bar Chista both have good support for their position, both in the fact that there's a brighta tosefta like them, and Rav Yossi bar Chanina paskin that way. So Savar Giad Igmar Rava, Amar Rav Sheshet, he holds like this view that halacha is nimnachim ba. We counsel with her, we give her a chance to work out her rebelliousness, her recalcitrance. We give her an opportunity to do tshuva. And how do we do that? That's like our Mishnah, Nichmachim, but we give her time. We work it out. We penalize her week after week to see if she will relent on her position. That we don't give any time to work this out. We do the 4 weeks, and after the 4 weeks, she loses her ketubah completely. So that's Rashi's explanation of the Gemara. First of all, that the machlok between Rava and Rav Nachman bar Chista is, who do we pass in like? Do we pass in like the Rabbeinu, or do we pass in like the Mishnah? And then the question of the Gemara is, who supports, or where is the position of Rava based on? And it's this machloket as to whether we give her an opportunity to work this out, or we do a much more drastic and immediate reaction to her rebelliousness, which is 4 weeks, and then she loses her ketubah, rather than this slow penalty where she leaks out her ketubah over a number of weeks. The Ritva points out that the question according to Gemara is a little bit interesting, because why are they asking what's Rava's position based on? Rava's position is based on the Mishnah. And so why do you have to ask? Who does he hold like? So the Ritva says that the question according to Rashi is, why did he call it Burcha? Why did he call someone who opposed the Mishnah a Burcha? That can't be because it's a Mishnah, because everybody knows a Mishnah. Burcha means that they didn't know certain pieces of knowledge that they should have known. And that is this other piece of knowledge about Nimlachim Ba or Ein Nimlachim Ba. They didn't realize that there's a necessity to give her time to work this out. That statement of the Amoraim is what he is chastising them for not knowing, why he called them a Burcha. And that's how the Ritva explains it according to Rashi. Most of the other Rishonim, including the Ran, believe that both Rava and Rav Nachman bar Rav Chista believe that the halacha is like Rabbeinu. That is because they just should have said explicitly, halacha k'Rabbeinu, or halacha k'Mishnatenu, instead of this clouded type of language which doesn't indicate who they paskin like. And so many of the Rishonim believe that they're arguing within the position of the Rabbeinu as to what is their position. For instance, here in the Bali Tosafot, the Rabbeinu Tam suggests that the machloka between them is the statement of Rami Bar Chama that Shochin Lami Beitin, Achat Kodim Achaza, Achat Achar Achraza, is at the halacha. So according to Rav Nachman Bar Chista, he says halacha k'Rabbeinu, exactly the way they said it. And they only said Machrizin and Shochim one time. And therefore he believes they only said it one time. Whereas according to Rava, the position of Rami Bar Chama is correct, and Beit Din sends it twice, once before the Achraza, once after the Achraza. And that's the machloket that we saw afterwards about Nimlachim Ba or Ein Nimlachim Ba. Do we give her time? Do we counsel with her to give her time to deal with the situation? Do we give her a warning beforehand and afterwards? Or we only get in touch with her once? And that's the machloket between Rava and Rav Nachman Bar Chista. The Ravid, on the other hand, suggests that Nimlachim Ba, the machloket between them, is do we ask her what she chooses to do? Meaning that Rav Nachman Bar Chista says that the loch is like Rabotenu, and that's it. We announce it for 4 weeks, and then she loses her whole ketubah. Rava says, no, Nimlachim Ba. We check with her. She can decide whether she wants to go the fast route, the quick route, or she wants to go the slow route. It's up to her. We check with her. Does she want to go the quick route, which is 4 weeks of warning, and then she loses her whole ketubah? Or does she want to go the slow route, and she'll lose a 7 dinar from her ketubah week after week until her ketubah disappears? How does she want to deal with this situation of her refusal? So we give her the opportunity to decide if she wants to take the path of the Mishnah or take the path of the Rabbeinu. That's Rava's position. That's what it means in Nimlachim Ba. Now, the Ran says about that position of the Ravid, of course, anybody would want to pick the Mishnah instead of Rabbeinu, because it gives her much more time to decide. She loses much less money on a weekly basis. Why wouldn't everybody pick that option? So the Ran suggests that the difference is be what which assets are exposed to this penalty that we saw earlier at the beginning of today's daf. That many of the Rishonim believe that the Nixay Malog in our Mishnah are at risk to the penalty. And therefore, according to Mishnah Tana, you go slower, but more of her assets are at risk, including the Nixay Malog. Whereas according to the Rabotenu, where she loses her entire ketubah in one shot after the 4 weeks of Achrazah, that does not include her Nixay Malog, because the Nixay Malog belong to her. The principal, the underlying asset belongs to her. And the husband's only entitled to payroll. If they terminate the marriage at the end of the 4 weeks and she loses her ketubah, she's still entitled to take back her Nixay Malog because they were not penalized. And therefore, she might opt to take in the Rabotenu to keep her Nixay Malog versus the slower version of the Mishnatenu. And then the Ran himself says, Velinira, Tahachi Kamar. This is the Machlokabit here. The Alocha Nimlochim Ba, the Losagi, Bimishulchaim Lami Beitin Lamar, Havi Yodat. You can't send messengers from Beitin in order for her to explain to her what's happening. Ela Beitin, Ba'atzma Nimlochim Ba. They have to counsel with her directly. Kodem shiyafsiku et hadin, lafsida et ktubata. Before she loses her ktubah, Nimlachim Ba, they have to go to her directly and deal with her directly. As opposed to the Rabotenu, which says Shulchim La Beit Din, Rava says, yes, the loch is like the Rabotenu, but the fact is that they have to actually deal with her directly, face to face, so she understands the implications of what she's doing and the resultant fine or penalty that she's going to have by losing her ktubah. And we're going to stop here, 5 lines down on the wide lines on Samach Gimel and Amud Bet.